Hi, everyone. I feel like I want to stand so I can see everyone. Thank you so much for coming out tonight. And Bob Scott is going to be really mad at me because I'm awful at holding microphones, even though I am in radio, which sounds absolutely ridiculous. I either get really excited and talk too close, so I apologize for that quickly. It's so nice for everyone to come out tonight. I know the weather has been a little crazy. I have an
but
extra...
If it gets dark enough and we're doing camping style issues
nails...
Stories. We'll answer your political questions while we shine a flashlight up into our face.
Because they're so scary.
I'm really serious. I have a rain jacket over there that I'm not using. If anyone wants to grab, you're more than welcome. It's blue and purple over there, and just grab it. But just leave it for me when you get back. So we have Rick Pluta, the Capitol Bureau Chief of the Michigan Public Radio Network here. Rick and I are co-hosts of It's Just Politics on Michigan Radio. And then if you are from Ann Arbor or in the Ann Arbor area or have heard of Ann Arbor, you most likely know who is to the left, maybe politically speaking either, but possibly, but we won't ever talk about Rick's personal politics, is Chris Kolb, a Democrat. Chris Kolb represented the 53rd District, Ann Arbor, in the State House of Reps. I guess there are people in here who voted for this man between 2001 and 2006. That seat was then held by Rebecca Warren, who is now your state senator, and that seat is now being held by Jeff Irwin, who was here last year. I was sort of hoping he would pop on by because he made an appearance and just kept talking and talking and talking, which was very fun to hear Jeff Irwin keep talking. And before Chris was a state rep, he was an Ann Arbor city councilman and also ran for mayor, which maybe we'll get a little bit into Ann Arbor politics. Mayoral politics, possibly. We're going to want to keep it a little more statewide, but if you've got questions about that, Chris can school us all on that. We are waiting for our Republican guests, so you can't say that we were super, like, NPR Pinky Radio and only invited a Democrat. We totally invited a Republican as well. Paul Welde is stuck in some traffic, so we are waiting a little bit for him. We're hoping he'll make it.
Although I have a favor to ask, that when he comes in, we'll introduce him. And so when I say, ladies and gentlemen, Paul Welde, could everyone just go, oh.
Right. Or now I know what you mean. Right. Now I get what you guys were saying about him.
Can we practice that? So if I say, you know, ladies and gentlemen, Paul Welde.
I kind of actually think that would be really funny.
Think that'll
I would
work?
Feel really bad for him, though, at the same time.
I don't.
Right, he accepted this invitation. He's getting free beer. Yeah. And also, get up in the middle and grab yourself more beverages and everything like that. We might as well do that. So make yourselves comfortable. There is a microphone that's set up here. We want to ask you to ask us questions. We can only talk so much, and we can talk and talk, and it really helps for you to jump in between so that we stop talking for a little bit and can answer questions, because what you guys want to know is way more important than what we think you want to know or what you should know and all of those things. Let's get started. And I think one of the things that Rick Pluta wanted to start out with was ballot proposals. My guess is a lot of people here in Ann Arbor have been paying attention to the wolf hunting ballot proposals. And I do say that plural. Rick, do you want to fill us in on what's going on with that?
Well, what?
How many? Two and a half?
I was going to say, how many? So shout it out. How many wolf hunting ballot proposals are there on the November ballot right now?
I'm hearing two. I'm hearing three. Chris went with 2.5, hedging his bets.
No, the answer is two. That the legislature, after the gray wolf was taken off the federal endangered species list, that the legislature added the gray wolf to the game hunting species in Michigan. And a bunch of animal rights groups led by the Humane Society ran a ballot campaign, got a referendum on the ballot, suspended the law. This really upset a lot of the hunters' rights groups and people in the Upper Peninsula where the wolves are, that they considered it something of an infringement on their local affairs. And so they got the legislature to pass a second law to not only allow wolf hunting, but also change how Michigan handles creating hunting seasons and hunting species. And that's actually rooted in kind of an ancient controversy. Do you remember the mourning doves? To yell it out or clap or something if you do.
Yeah.
Yeah. That the legislature.
Or drink some more beer and then start yelling things out.
I think.
It was 2006.
It was 2006 that the legislature legalized mourning dove hunting, that the Humane Society, the Audubon Society went to the ballot, referendumed it, and killed that hunting season, no pun intended. And the hunters groups vowed never again. And so when they did it with the wolf hunting season, after the second law was subject to a referendum, a bunch of hunters' rights groups got together and they did a petition drive. And we've done an IJP on this, that it was a petition drive to allow wolf hunting, to take establishing hunting species, game species, out of the hands of the legislature, although they could still pass a law, and put it with the Natural Resources Commission, whose actions are not subject to referendum. And along the way, what else?
Keep going. Just keep going.
Did any of you sign a petition to get rid of Asian carp in the Great Lakes? You signed a petition to permit wolf hunting in the Upper Peninsula.
Wah, wah, wah.
Well, I don't know. Maybe she was for that wolf. I mean, let's not make any assumptions.
That very well could be. I guess now, I want
to pick. And did you sign a petition to give free hunting and fishing licenses to veterans?
To veterans, yeah.
Yes, anyone? Because if you did, you also signed a petition to permit wolf hunting in the Upper Peninsula and change how Michigan handles establishing game species. Well, the state Senate is back in Lansing tomorrow, and that initiative is up for a vote. And if the Senate approves it, and then next week or the week after that, the House comes back and approves it, it becomes a state law. And because of that $1 million that's in it for Asian carp, that also means that it can't be subject to a referendum.
Right, which you've probably heard some of those things. I want to turn it over to Chris.
Or Chris.
Or
the Constitution says that appropriations can't be in referendum. Bill, so
the
action's illegal.
Is
that you can't do a citizen's initiative with an appropriations in it. And if you do, then it is open for a referendum.
Yeah.
And so we're probably going to end up in court one way or the other.
one way or another, a lot of lawyers are going to make a lot of money, which is not surprising. I guess I want to go to
Chris for a second.
Okay. I want to go to Chris for a second because Chris is our guest who's here, and I would like to give him a little bit of time.
Give our guest a chance.
Chris, talk to me a little bit about, as you've been watching what's been happening, particularly with ballot initiatives in 2012, six on the ballot in November that probably everyone remembers. Talk a little bit about this increase in ballots that have been happening. As a former state lawmaker, what does that tell you about the process of where lawmakers are making laws as opposed to making laws via ballots?
Or where they're not making laws.
Sure,
and I think that's really, I think that the case is coming that Lansing is broken. Nothing can get done. So if you want to pass something, you're just going to have to go to the voters. Now, I can tell you there's a lot of powerful interest in Lansing who have opposed that, but they're getting as frustrated as everybody else. And you can look at the transportation funding legislation that just has been going round and round and round for the last 4 years, and nothing can get done, and our roads and our transportation system is just getting worse and worse. And here you have one of the number one issues in the state, and no one has the backbone to get up and vote yes on any proposal. So thus, what's the answer? And the answer is becoming go to the voters, trust the voters, and let them decide when Lansing can't.
Well, I don't know. I've got to quibble with the premise, though, that in this particular, I mean, you may not like what Lansing has done, but there's been big stuff happening, that we have a right-to-work law, that there was a huge fight over the Medicaid expansion. Yes, road funding isn't done, and the last initiated law that we had was a bill that was passed by the legislature to, among other things, forbid abortion coverage as part of a basic health coverage plan, and that was done to get around a veto of the governor, not inaction by the legislature.
Although, Rick, you bring me to a nice bridge. I love when you do that. Thank you. Talking about the minimum wage, because that was actually possibly going to be a law that was voter-initiated. Let's talk a little bit about what happened, because my guess is if some of you didn't vote on a wolf hunting proposal, that maybe you did vote on the minimum wage to raise.
You mean
Michigan's
sign a petition for a minimum wage?
Yeah. So how many? Can I see hands? Just because I'm interested to know how many people here did. Okay. So you now know that is not going to be on the ballot. Is everyone aware that happened? Yeah, okay. So let's talk a little bit about, I don't know if trickery is the right word necessarily, but what happened with that ballot and why folks who
actually,
did,
one of the interesting things about the minimum wage ballot was that it was knocked off the ballot the old-fashioned way, which was not enough signatures. That it used to be that people who do what I do at this recent time of the year would spend hours and hours and hours in a room with the Board of State canvassers while attorneys tried to argue that these four signatures were duplicates and so they all needed to be knocked off, or this petition circulator was not valid and so they needed to be knocked off. And it was just a long, tedious process. And now signature gathering has become so professionalized that In most cases, if you get your petitions turned in, you've got hundreds of thousands more signatures than you need, and that's where the minimum wage drive actually fell short. But in 2014, it's an anomaly.
Yeah. Any questions about the minimum wage or wolf hunting before we move on? I see hands. No, and just a reminder: if you do have questions, totally feel free to get up in that mic and we'll take them. Let's move a little bit, because before we got started, a couple people wanted to talk about the state legislature, which is something I would like to talk about. Chris Cole, my guess is you would like to talk about it. Let's start with things that didn't get done. We'll try to keep it quick. And then, here on the front, we don't have all night. Very true. Let's talk quickly, though, about roads, because that was one of the things that you had asked about. And to succinctly sort of try to describe, and succinctly being the operative word there, Rick, what happened with roads?
Nothing.
Okay, so moving on.
You're welcome. What happened was that the legislature could not agree on a revenue source, and there is still a critical mass of Tea Party influence in legislators' districts, Republican legislators' districts, saying that any type of revenue source is unnecessary, that there is still room enough to cut to raise the money needed for roads, and an argument over whether or not the governor's number of $1.2 billion is actually even accurate, although most of the estimates actually say that that's short, that it's more like $2 billion that we really need for roads. So it was sort of the double-edged sword. And we'll see what happens with road funding going ahead, because even though incumbents were concerned about Tea Party challenges, Republican incumbents, only one incumbent Republican was beat by a Tea Partier, and it was probably not because
of
road funding.
And I'd like to get to Frank Foster, but I want to turn to you again, Chris. How surprised were you that road funding didn't get done? I mean, it seemed to political analysts that this was going to happen, that, and instead we saw minimum wage, we saw a huge Detroit package, but I think most people would have bet more money on the fact that roads would get done. What's your analysis on that?
I think there's several things. I think Rick pointed out the Tea Party influence. You have Matty Maroon, who's pumped a ton of money into Lansing, who's the owner of the Ambassador Bridge. Americans for Prosperity here in Michigan are funded by Matty. So there's a lot inside a caucus, and there's, 26 members in the Republican caucus right now?
Mm-hmm. Yep. 26 to 12.
In the Senate side.
Right. The House passed, okay, everyone knows, the House passed some general fund money into about $400 million in a need of, and that's a one time only, when you need about $2.5 billion, and it's growing. Every year we don't do something, the number keeps getting bigger. You need it for your roads, your bridges, for your buses, your public transportation, your biking, walking. All your modes of transportation are just as important. So you need about $2.5 billion. Well, we were going to get close to over $1.5 billion in the Senate if they could only put together the deal. The legislation passed the minimum wage legislation, which was part of the deal. That got everyone to the table and talking.
Excuse and then, me, just, ladies and gentlemen, Paul Welday.
Oh. Okay, explain quickly, please. Yes. Explain quickly.
Welcome to Ann Arbor.
Okay, we might have set them up
there,
to do that, Paul. Make yourself comfortable.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Good evening, everyone. How are you? It's great to be here.
Yeah. Paul, can we have someone grab you a beverage?
Yes.
Yeah, beverage. Just shout it out.
Water would be
water.
Great. Thank you very much.
Well, day of water.
Thank you.
Paul, just to quickly fill you in, we're talking about roads. Chris Kolb is sort of giving us a quick rundown.
Well, can we take a moment to introduce Paul?
Yes. Oh, I thought we did it at
the
very beginning.
Paul is actually one of the most ambitious people I know, because Paul is the Republican Party chairman for the 14th Congressional District, which is the most Democratic congressional district in the state.
A little bit like being the cruise director on the Titanic. You know, I mean, we have fun for a while, but we know it's going to end.
He's also a political consultant who's been involved in a wide variety of issues and not necessarily on a partisan basis. And he's also been around for almost as long as we've had dirt. So.
Paul was also the chair
of
the Oakland County Republican Party. He was the Republican nominee for the Michigan House of Reps and, excuse me, for the actual United States House of Representatives in 2008, leading candidate for Congress in the 9th Congressional District in 2010. That's actually the district currently held by Gary Peters. Gary Peters now, of course, running for the open Senate seat that Carl Levin is leaving. So, Paul Welday, welcome.
We're actually, let me just correct you a little bit.
Please.
In 2008, I ran for the Michigan House of Representatives, and I lost in the general election. It was not a good year to be a Republican, by the way. And
there was this guy named Obama at the top of the
ticket.
Yeah,
exactly.
Right. Yeah.
And then in 2010, I thought, well, listen, I might have come this far. Might as well run for Congress. Well, I thought it might be a good Republican year in 2010, and I was right. But what I didn't anticipate was the rise of the Tea Party. And I was a candidate running on experience, and that just didn't work very well for me. And I lost in the primary to a guy by the name of Rocky Raskowski. And Rocky ended up losing to Gary Peters. And in the Republican Party, yeah, we say, look, that was the one race we could have won and should have won and didn't win for the GOP. But here we are tonight, and I'm glad to be here.
We are super glad to have you, as I pour a little more cider. I'm sorry about that. Okay, so we were talking roads. Should we move on to LGBT rights and Elliot Larson? This is something
we were talking about Frank Foster, so what?
Okay, I was just going to say that there was a deal for roads.
Okay.
And the deal just fell apart at the last moment. They needed about two more Republican votes. There were two more Democratic votes if they would have put on increase the fees for trucks and then increase the penalty for being overweight. The Senate wouldn't do that. Thank you, Tom Casperson. But at the same point, like often in Lansing, when you have a really big deal, the more complicated, the more moving parts, the more chances it's going to fall apart. And about 11:30 to about 1:30 at night, the deal fell apart, and we're sitting here with crumbling roads and infrastructure.
Well, we should point out that, you know, that we pay a lot of attention in politics to Republicans versus Democrats. But in fact, there are a lot of rivalries. One of the biggest ones, actually, Chris can speak to this, is House versus Senate. That you know, who will get credit, who will get there first. Right now, the Senate Republicans are very suspicious of House Republicans, it's the other way around. House Republicans suspicious of Senate Republicans because they've gone first on some tax hikes, and then the Senate has come back and gone, you know, we know you took a tough vote, but we're not ready to go there yet. So, you know, sorry, guys. There are also, and some of it is issues in philosophy. So, you know, we know a lot about the schism between Tea Party Republicans and what we call establishment Republicans, pro-business, infrastructure, investment Republicans. In the Democratic coalition, you can have environment versus labor, versus LGBT versus some women's issues, and people who say that we need to spend, you know, we're spending too much time on this and not enough on that. And Detroit, that the Detroit caucus is very often, you know, its own, you know, mini caucus within the within the Democratic coalition.
And so
what
I think you're explaining is that it's nuanced. It's very easy to sometimes say Republicans versus Democrats, Snyder versus this. But there's a lot of different issues. And at heart are people trying to keep their jobs for good or for bad.
Well, you may have covered this, and I apologize if you have. But how many people here are familiar with the term lame duck session of the legislature? Raise your hand. Okay. Most of you are. And that's good because issues like transportation, issues like Elliot Larson revision, I mean, a whole host of things get pushed off until the lame duck session because no one wants to take a vote that's going to maybe put them in a bad light before the election.
Yeah.
So they bring it all up on the table, and it's often said that 80% of the legislature's work gets done in the last 2 weeks. That could be the same this year as well.
And it's what we saw with Right to Work, which is what we were talking a little bit about. So let's look to September. State lawmakers, the state senators will be back tomorrow for a quick session, as Rick was talking about, to take up wolf hunting. But let's look towards September when recess is done. Let's talk a little bit about the things that we might see. And one of them is adding LGBT rights to the state Civil Rights Act. That's called the Elliot Larson Civil Rights Act. And it's protections for people right now, race, gender, ethnicity, gay
weight, marital status. Right. It's probably one of the country's most comprehensive mm-hmm. civil rights laws, mm-hmm. Absent sexual orientation.
Yeah. And Chris, I would love for you to jump in and let us know how interesting it is to see after you were in the legislature when in 2004 a majority, I think about 70%, 69% of Michiganders voted against same-sex marriage. Now, these are two different issues, but I guess I want to talk a little bit about the swing of issues that have to do with LGBT rights in Michigan and how you're watching them and what your perspective is.
I think there's really two, I think, things going. There's probably three things going on. From a national perspective, the country's moved forward on the issues across the spectrum, whether it's just non-discrimination, hate crimes, or same-sex marriage issue. The country is moving forward on that, more accepting of that. In Michigan, then, I think we've seen a lot of corporations are starting to get behind this as well. We know that the number one economic development tool is talent attraction. If your state's not attractive to young, talented, educated employees, you can kiss your future goodbye. And so we know that Michigan has all these great assets, be it the research universities, our natural resources, but we're still seen as being stuck in the 50s in most cases on social issues. So the businesses are starting to say, you know, that's not what's going to help us recruit the best and the brightest to be here in Michigan, either stay here or come here, so we can really grow our companies and our future. So that's a big thing going on. And then third thing that's going on, I think, is you have some younger Republicans who really disagree with the image that the GOP has nationally. And that's not the party that they want to be a part of, and they don't want that to be the image of the Republican Party. And Frank Foster is one of those individuals who said, that's not the party image that I want for my party. And so I'm going to go out front on an issue of extending civil rights protections to the LGBT community here in Michigan.
And we're going to circle back on that in a moment, but a question for both of you. Then, why has Rick Snyder been so slow to embrace adding LGBT rights to Larson Act?
You know Rick Snyder as well as anyone. Both of you cover him in his administration. He's as focused as any politician ever will be. It is not on his radar screen. And when he says that, he means that. And the truth be told, the last poll, if you will, that I saw here of the state of Michigan showed that gay marriage, anyway, was opposed by about 50%. So this is still not a settled question. It's not settled within the public at large, and it's certainly not settled within the Republican Party. I agree with Chris. There are a number of younger Republicans, maybe some older ones too, who look at the issue and maybe have a more enlightened view. But we've also had our fights within the Republican Party. We got a guy named Dave Ajima, who is the Republican National
Committee. How many people here have heard of Dave Ajima?
Yeah. Not expecting him to get a warm response here tonight, but I'm not sure. That might have been better than my response. Well, anyway. But Dave Ajima has been someone who has really polarized and really caused tremendous problems for the Republican Party from a messaging standpoint, from a perception standpoint. Some of us have pushed for his ouster, including the governor, and we have yet to have the mechanism to do that. So I guess my point is that this is still not settled, and it's not going to be in this election, whether it's gay marriage, certainly. But even the Elliot Larson changes, with Frank Foster's loss in the primary last week, it really puts a damper on any enthusiasm to move, and certainly move quickly, any changes to Elliot Larson.
Although there are sort of opposing forces at play there. Frank Foster has told the Petoskey News Review that he intends to come back to Lansing and introduce that bill. It still has not been introduced. It could not be voted on for at least 5 session days, because that's what the state constitution says in both the House and the Senate. But he says he's going to introduce it, and they would like to get it done actually before the November election, but in lame duck if necessary, because with the heightened number of Tea Partiers that will be coming into the state house at least next year, they don't see it happening for at least a couple of sessions otherwise, so that also increases the pressure to get
and
something
it
done.
It could right happen now. In lame duck. It's not going to happen in November. Frank Foster can introduce it as much as he wants, but he still has to get 56 votes in the House, and I don't think he's anywhere
20
close
votes
to
in the
that.
Senate.
Yeah. Correct.
Paul, how important do you think it is, though, that we saw the governor in May come out with about 20 business leaders, or the 20 business leaders on Mackinac Island said it's time, then after a day later, Governor Snyder wouldn't actually say, and Rick and I had a one-on-one with him, and we tried to press him, and he would
that
not...
That would be a two-on-one.
A two-on-one. I don't even want to go there.
Well, in answer to your question, it's significant.
Yeah.
It's significant.
So, and I'm moving on.
There's no doubt that society is moving towards a more accepting position of the LGBT community than it has in the past.
So, Paul, what is the breaking point then? I mean, at what point is it just accepted within the Republican Party that this is where the party is going, and that then the minority, like a Todd Corser, who's going to be coming in January, who is absolutely anti-gay marriage and things like that? I mean, do you see a breaking point, and where is that?
It's not immediately on the horizon, because it's going to take these members to go back to their home districts in Roseville or in Ortonville or, you know, all across the state, and to get the feedback that this is something that people are looking for. Frankly, it's not something that's really a pressing issue outside a few select communities or areas of the state, honestly.
And we should point out that the evolution of public opinion on this is very nuanced, that even among people who believe that either we should add LGBT to Elliot Larson or allow same-sex marriage. There is a slight majority still in Michigan, apparently, that is not in favor of adding same-sex marriage, mm-hmm. although it's a very slight majority and it's moving. But also, there are people who will tell pollsters, and public opinion research is very dicey, especially, you know, right now. We've talked about this a lot. There's a lot of crap polling out there. But it seems as if there are people who favor same-sex marriage but are still suspicious of same-sex marriage, and there's some overlap there. And so even the direction that people are moving in, it's kind of sketchy. Yeah.
Okay, we have been talking for a really long time, and I'm hoping that there are folks with questions. We want to hear from you. Like I said, we can just keep – oh, yeah.
You want to step up to the microphone?
Yeah, do you mind? Or just shout it out?
You want to shout it out?
No worries. We haven't answered it, and it's a great discussion to get
into.
Oh,
my God. We just spent 90 minutes on it.
Where have you been?
Where have you been? Yeah.
Rick, do you want to just try to quickly fill us in, about this big article that came out from the Detroit Free Press, 2-year investigation?
The Detroit Free Press ran a long series that raised a lot of questions about charter schools, especially those operated by for-profit charter companies, some of which are based in Michigan. And it just found a lot of issues. The charter schools say that the Free Press series left out a lot of stuff, especially as far as being as tough on charters that are not performing, or being as tough on traditional public schools that are not performing as charters. That said, we're sort of forming kind of a standoff between the State Board of Education, which has a majority of Democrats, and if you really want to get down to the weeds, we could talk about why that is the case versus the legislature, which is Republican. We are not going to see a lot of new controls on charter schools and for-profit companies that run charter schools under the current configuration of state government, which is Republican majorities in the House and the Senate and the governor's office. There are just too many people who are sympathetic to the charter experiment.
Chris,
so that's where that stands right now.
From a legislative perspective, when and how, and I think it can maybe go back to Prop A, I mean, what is the role of lawmakers in education? Where are you seeing that go from when you were in office to what it is now? A lot of it has to do with unions and Republicans who control the state legislature.
You summed it up. I mean,
okay, so again, moving on.
I mean, Tony's here, and Tony Derenczynski is state senator from Muskegon, Ann Arbor City Council member.
Education lobbyist.
Yes. You know, education is...
Motorcycle rider.
More... It's not something that gets solved by sound bites. It's not a, we'll have charters, we'll have public education. When I was in the legislature, when I was staffing right before that, we focused forever on failing schools. No one ever talked about what are the characteristics of a successful school. How are kids successful? What schools work and why? We just beat up on public education. We just beat up on the neighborhood schools. And we said we needed, for these failing schools who don't have enough money, you know the characteristics of why children succeed. And it usually has to do with the parents' income, the parents' education level, what neighborhoods they're coming from. But those are really complicated issues. In the era of term limits, we don't have time for that. And if you do study up, time you know what you really are doing, you're kicked out for your 6 years are over and you're done with. So it takes time. I think the Free Press did a really nice job of at least laying all of the issues on the table of what's going on in the charter of school systems. The lack of oversight by some of the issuers of the charters, their responsibilities. We have a couple of universities, more than one or two, who are failing probably to doing their job of overseeing those charters. We know that in Detroit, you have a really tough population, a really tough situation, so getting something really going there. But each dollar we send to a charter school goes outside of the public, traditional
But remember, too, the environment.
I want to get Paul's voice in this, yeah.
Well, as long as I've been around, and again, I guess it's no surprise this is an election year because somebody's going to be in the crosshairs. And as long as I've been around, it's either been, let's beat up on the public schools, let's beat up on charter schools. It goes back and forth. It seems to me if there was ever an issue that we could set partisanship aside, this would be it. I mean, it's about what can we do for these kids who need our help. And, we can disagree on a lot of stuff as Republicans and Democrats, but on the issue of education of our children, let's set that aside and go to work.
But also, can I just put one thing in there?
Yes, please.
Because I want to put what Paul's, said. I think the one area that we have seen a coming together is on early childhood education. And
yes.
that we went from adding...
That's a great model.
$15 million with Grand Home. We then got $60 million with Snyder 1 year and another $60 million, I think, this year. So we're seeing some movement on early childhood education that's going to be good. We need to bring the same sort of forces together that brought that coalition together to move education forward, to work on education. And I agree, we need to look at what is successful, what does it mean to be successful for a child, making sure that we get a year's progress, whatever that is, for each child and being where the child's at. And if we're going to be successful here in Michigan, we need to make investments and improve our public education system as well. We know that. And I'm glad
to
hear you
say that.
But remember
what the environment was when the choice and charter movement was launching here. And the people here have seen the movie Waiting for Superman. Was that the name, the one about the charter school?
Yeah.
I remember years ago during the Engler versus Wolpe campaign, I was giving the Howard Wolpe's campaign manager a hard time because he school choiced his daughter. He lived in Lansing. And he said that choice in charters is actually the urban liberals' dirty little secret.
Just quickly, there's a couple seats here if you want to scooch in. Right. It looks like they're scooch. We'll get real cozy. Yeah. Steve Kropinski, our weatherman, is saying it's a momentary rain. So let's everyone get real close.
Well, I think everyone has found shelter.
Oh, good, good. And I'm serious about that rain jacket. I have one there. Anyone that wants it is more than welcome
to grab
it.
I'll donate my coat.
Okay, Rick, sorry. Go ahead.
And what he said was that choice and charters are the urban liberals' dirty little secret, because what it did was that they allowed families to remain in the neighborhoods where they were living without having to move, to sell their house and move to get to a better district. And that was also at the time when we were still caught up, and we are still caught up, in the whole discussion about how much each school district gets to spend per student, but that it was a product of frustration, and part of it was certainly Republican frustration with teachers' unions, no doubt, but it was also a product of frustration with people who felt like they couldn't get the schools to move off the dime for their kids.
I also think it's parents' frustration. I mean, let's be honest. 1950, Detroit was a city of 2 million people. Now, there are a number of factors as to why it's now a city of 700,000 or less, but one of the big issues there has been the Detroit public schools. They have deteriorated significantly. There's been a polarization between the unions, the city. I mean, just a mess. And how many
and an evaporation of finances as people have left the city.
Absolutely. Exactly. It becomes a bit of a death spiral. But the fact of the matter is people say, I don't want this environment for my kids, so I'm going to move. And you can understand that. Or now charters and some other choices are available to them, and they should have those choices, at least in my view.
Well, can I just get a corner point?
Yeah.
You know, Chicago has really bad public schools. How many people are in Chicago? How many people are moving to Chicago? Public schools are important. Education is important for a community, but it doesn't, you know, determine if you're going to live there or not. And I can give you lots of appointments.
I disagree.
New York City. Come on, let's look. New York City, Chicago, Washington, D.C., L.A. I mean, we can go on Miami. But the thing is that what people know is that only about 50% of success is from the classroom. The other important aspect is on the outside of the classroom. It's the parents. It's the neighborhood. Those things. If people think that we can just go, I know, talking crazy. You know, if you can just, we're going to put our kids in school and that's all we have to do, we're not going to have success there.
So we've got some questions lined up. I do want to ask one really quick question to Paul, and this may not be a quick answer, but one of the things that Schauer and Democrats have been hammering Snyder on is school cuts, K through 12 cuts. And you're talking about the need for public education. Are we funding public education like it
should
be in order
wrong.
To get some of the results?
Schauer is wrong.
Right, and we can get into that. We'll get in a little bit into that when we talk a little bit more about the gubernatorial campaign and the U.S. Senate campaign. But we've got some questions. Yay!
My question is regarding the funding for the roads. A lot of people understand that we pay the fuel tax, and it goes to Washington, and then every state gets some portion of it. And a lot of people think, which I talk to, that we get the minimum back from Washington. Now, this local funding here, as a lot of us understand, is a matching money that we have to raise to get that money. Could you clarify that? What's the problem?
So we got a little bit into roads at the
Is this the donor state question?
Yeah, we got a little bit into roads, so let's quickly, and there's something different between how the gas tax works and then how much money we get from the federal government.
Let me take one quick crack at this. I used to work for a congressman by the name of Joe Nolenberg. He was the chairman of the House Subcommittee of Transportation on Appropriations. So road money at the federal level is formula-based. However, there's always been traditionally a source, a pot of money that the members of Congress have been able to use to direct back to their home districts and their home states. But Washington has essentially eliminated earmarking for everything, including road projects to a large degree. There's some of that, but we don't have nearly the influence in the spending of federal dollars because, number one, we don't have an appropriator anymore, and number two, the earmarking process ain't what it used to be.
Well, there's also something else, that donor state is something of a fiction. We are a donor state, but we're barely a donor state.
It's very true.
We're barely a donor state, and a large reason for that is because we have these low population states like South Dakota and Nebraska that also have roads that run through them.
And so they get a lot of money.
So they get a lot more money per capita.
I also want to give a quick shout out to Mark.
Yes, going to make a follow-up comment. That seems to be one of the issues that we pay one of the least in fuel taxes in the union.
Yeah.
And people should understand that, you know, you have to pay for what you get.
And I want to quickly.
And we are not paying at all as compared to many other states.
It's very true that, states like Ohio are almost paying double in the gas tax. I want to just quickly give a shout out to our website, because Mark Brush of Michigan Radio did an amazing job breaking all of this down. It is literally one of the most clear, articulate ways to better understand the gas tax. And so please go to michiganradio.org and Google gas tax along with that in our search box. Mark Brush did a wonderful job, and I really hope that that will explain it better. Let's go to another question, just because you've been waiting in the rain.
Hi, guys. Hello. Ooh, I'm so nervous.
Deep breath.
So since starting work here at the Garden, I've become aware of regulations put on the liquor and alcoholic beverage industry in Michigan by the MLCC,
yeah.
Whether it's limiting...
The Michigan Liquor Control Commission.
Yes, thank you. Whether it's limiting the ability to distribute beer, which I know was resolved somewhat earlier this year, or limiting the amount of liquor licenses that are available in each city, a lot of it seems to be limiting to small businesses and favoring places that might be able to afford buying a liquor license that the smaller businesses in a local community weren't able to afford. And it might be my ignorance, but to me it seems like these limitations come from some sort of like moral regulation, and I'm not sure what they do to support the community. It seems to put limitations.
We could do a whole show on the three-tier system of alcohol management in the state. And you're right. The system that we have today in this state is an offshoot of the end of Prohibition. We're living with that same style. And the fact is, there's anything but a free market in the area of spirit, distilled spirits, beer and wine in this state. It's a complicated issue, but you're right. And, you know, I'm not sure there's an easy or quick answer to this question.
How much does it have to do with lobbyists and money and not wanting to change?
Everything has something to do with lobbyists and money.
I love you, Paul. That was the answer I wanted.
The Michigan Licensed Beverage Association is a huge power in Lansing. Right. And no one
beer and wine is probably bigger.
Beer and wine wholesalers are bigger. I'm sorry.
Trips down to Louisiana.
Mm-hmm. But,
Chris, tell us. Were there colleagues of yours who went down south for trips?
Every spring break, hell yeah. And sometimes it's not just Louisiana.
Their lobbyist has
sometimes
a resort.
I actually voted for and sponsored something about being able to direct shipment of wine, and so I'm not really on their list of good people.
Right.
So I guess I can say what I want to say. But,
please, this is what we're
but
here
they do.
For.
I got to say this. I mean, lobbyists get a bad name. And I think they do provide, you know, valuable information. It's when money and influence gets out of whack that you have some problems. And in this case, we fought really hard. We've started to open up. They have brew pubs. We got microbreweries. We've been able to deal with direct shipments and some other things that we are starting to modernize it. But it goes way back to the Prohibition.
Yeah, and in this session, the legislature did act to relax the rules for startup craft brewers to distribute. So,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Okay.
Slowly.
Do we have any other questions? I can't tell if people are in line or no. Okay.
We're just trying to stay out of the line. Tony Darazinski.
Yeah, just one comment. You mentioned charter schools. The article in the Free Press, the 10-page or 10-issue article, which was really good, did mention a very successful charter school here in Ann Arbor, which is Honey Creek Community School. It is chartered, actually, by the Intermediate School District. So about 20% of the charters in Michigan are chartered by regular school districts or intermediate districts for very specific reasons. And that's the ones that are successful usually. And I think just keep your eye on that ball, because there will be more supervision of them, and I think that's inevitable. But you don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. You got to be careful, because some of them can be successful. I'm a little biased. I was on the board at Honey Creek. And when I worked for the School Board Association, they were, let's say, quizzical about my doing that. But the fact is that they can be useful for specific reasons. And I think that's where you have to be careful. I know Mike Flanagan right now is looking at them. There will be more reporting requirements, which I think are good. And I think there'll be more enforcement of it. But they're going to be inevitable. But, you know, when they're useful is when they're specific. And I think that's where the rub will come.
Although I think the political reality is that if it doesn't come out of the State Board of Education, it's probably not going to happen in the legislature.
Okay. Do you have a question over here? Yeah, jump on in. As Tamar Charney, yes. Our program director at Michigan Radio. Woo-hoo,
thank
Tamar!
You.
just trying to lay low, but I couldn't help myself.
Hi, quick, we've mostly been sticking with statewide issues, but I was just wondering if we could have a little more political analysis on the federal level, and especially the post-primary.
Yeah.
Mostly, Michigan is a fairly gerrymandered state, but I was just wondering if you knew of any races that you think might be very competitive in November.
Sure.
Especially the chances of flipping either the 8th or the 11th district.
Oh my gosh.
And what the candidates that came out of the primaries look like in their chances.
I love you. Do you want to just come and grab a stool? This is literally next on my list to get.
And we're off. Do you want my resume too?
Yes, I
really
let's start with
Paul.
To primary analysis, and I would love to talk about some congressional districts.
Sure.
Paul, jump in. Have at it.
Love to. And I think it's a great question. You're right. Most of the districts in Michigan, the congressional districts, there are 14, are pretty much decided in primaries. And you mentioned the 8th district, which is a district that runs from Lansing into northern Oakland County. It was held by Congressman Mike Rogers. He announced his retirement. The primary was won by Mike Bishop, the former state Senate majority leader. He will win in November. In the 11th district, which was once held by...
That is not a competitive race.
Not a competitive race. And in the 11th district, which was once held by Thaddeus McCotter, and then held by the infamous Kerry Bentivoglio, or as we like to call him, the accidental congressman.
I thought we'd call them the Santa Claus impersonator.
Well, we call them a lot of things if you want to know the truth. But the truth is, Dave Trott beat him by a 2-1 margin, a challenger, beat Bentivoglio last Tuesday, and Dave Trott will win handily.
I'll put an asterisk on that one, which is that Dave Trott...
How about putting a $20 bill on that one?
How about another beer?
that's a start.
I'm not sure I'm willing to bet $20, but the asterisk is that David Trott is the quote-unquote foreclosure king of Southeast Michigan, and if everything else turns out right for Democrats in a year when everything else will probably not turn out right for Democrats, they could conceivably... take the 11th if they run if they can run a strong.
I know Chris
campaign.
Has got a thought, but I don't want to monopolize this. But I do have to say this: there are two different electorates in Michigan, one that comes out to vote in presidential years, and another that comes out to vote in midterms.
And that's
elections.
What's not working for Democrats.
Precisely.
In this cycle.
Republicans win in midterms. Republicans have a tough time in presidential elections. This midterm election, particularly the sixth year of the Obama administration, a midterm election, all the factors are working
exactly.
against Democrats.
Yeah.
So frankly, I think that this is going to be a very good Republican year. It may not be quite as good as 2010 for Republicans, but I think that in the congressional races, there's going to be no changes in the delegation.
And what Paul's analysis deals with is why Democrats are fixated on voter turnout and trying to convince about a third of the Obama voters who we strongly suspect will stay home, convince them to get out and vote and vote in November. And that's the game.
And I want to quickly just talk about what these primaries are doing. We had an 18% turnout last week here in Michigan. But this is not just a Michigan issue. There are 435 seats in the U.S. House of Reps. What we know, about 70 of those. 70 seats out of 435 are actually going to be competitive come November. So it's not just a Michigan issue. This is happening all over the country. Okay,
and we
Chris,
do have two more.
We would be remiss in not mentioning a former colleague of mine and just down the road, Pam Burns is running against Tim Walberg. That's a race that
in the 7th. Yeah.
Yes, could be competitive.
If you can upend the turnout model.
Yeah, you can get your people. It's getting your people to the polls. And that's what Lon Johnson, the Michigan Democratic Party chair, is all about, using technology, using everything that the Obama campaign did. I think his wife knows something about that, having been in the Obama campaign. But two, it's finding, when you're a challenger, you got to catch your breaks. And when you do, you got to move quick and move decisively. We'll see. I agree on the whole. We probably won't see too many changes, but there are several that we could see.
One other related issue, and I think it really is the bigger issue, is the change in the Michigan delegation in its entirety. We're going to have 5 new members out of 14 in the Michigan delegation. And in a system built on seniority, this is a sea change in terms of Michigan's
135 years, Rick and I did the math, of combined experience leaving come January.
Now, hopefully, if we're in Ann Arbor's sake that they won't recognize there's a new dingle in town. But by the same token, Debbie's going to approach this a lot different from John stylistically, if nothing else. So she's one of the five new faces we're going to see in this delegation. And it's going to be interesting to watch.
And I want to quickly note before we go to a question, just a second, because I've got to get this in, that Debbie Dingell and Brenda Lawrence, although we are losing some congressional cut, we are also getting two new congresswomen. So I just needed to throw that in there. I know, right? Okay.
And then last but not least, what could be on paper, at least, we'll see how it turns out in November, one of the most competitive congressional races in the country, which is north of Clare, the first congressional district that takes up northern Michigan and the Upper Peninsula, the only competitive congressional seat in the country that's been targeted by the DCCC because they think that their candidate actually has a better chance without Barack Obama.
Yeah,
at
it's
the
interesting.
Top of the
Dan Benishek doesn't get a lot of attention in that race, nor does Jerry Cannon. But keep an eye on the first, which is the entire UP and quite a bit of upper lower Michigan. That'll be an interesting race that national Republicans and
it's
and
actually the largest congressional district east of the Mississippi River.
Right. Okay, we have a question.
Okay, I have a. First, I'd like each of you to answer this question. How do you feel about gerrymandering, and what's the answer to not having it happen? I have two questions, but that's the first one. Well, how do you change that so that we don't have this every, whatever, 10 years, people make these weird districts so that you can get either all Republican or all Democrat?
Eliminate political parties.
That's your answer, okay. That's one answer.
Yeah, Paul, do you want to jump in?
I don't think you are going to get rid of it. Eldridge Gerry, who it's named for, was one of the founding fathers. This is an American tradition like motherhood and apple pie.
You could go with a bipartisan, committee
that's been trying to do it.
You know, what's really happened is that in the old, can I just expand a little bit because it's kind of fun. In the old days, each party used to take over a gymnasium, lay out this huge map of Michigan, and they hand calculated all the calculations you had to do to get the right vote so that all the districts, change. Calculators made it easier. But with computers today, what took weeks takes minutes to run and redo everything. And the digital age has really made this into a science that they know exactly what the outcome is going
and
to be.
And what car you drive and where you shop. And actually, they're using things like that. Are you a Target voter? Are you a Walmart shopper?
But not to draw districts.
No, but I'm just saying that how technology is changing.
But if I could, the most important election is the ought-year election. Because it is in that year that the census is done. And Republicans have had the upper hand with regard to drawing the map because in the ought-year elections, we have won the governorship, both houses of the legislature, and a majority on the state Supreme Court. Mm-hmm. Guess what? Game over.
Right.
Not only in 2010, but in 2000. Yeah. If that were split, you'd see a very different set of lines in the state.
Do you think this is appropriate way to run this political system that one group gets to game the system to put people they want in instead of allowing people to make their decisions based on a majority?
I think it's going to happen either way. You could say that. You could say, well, we're going to be fair. We're going to take the politics. You can't take the water off the wet. That's what this is.
You could, and I think states are experimenting to see it. California with the top two primaries, where the top two vote getters of regardless of party go into the general election is one case. You could, whether you talk about gerrymandering or not, you could also do. I mean, our primary's in August. Hello, who's paying attention in August? So let's move it to September. Maybe May is another. There's a lot of ideas out there. The Bridge just did a report not just recently on all the things that are out there. We can make it fair. Yeah. And you know what? If you're in the majority, maybe you think it's working. When you're in the minority, I can tell you it's not working at all.
Short answer is you can't entirely take the politics out of politics.
But also keep an eye on what's happening in Florida right now, because that is split and it is complete chaos right now, that a judge right now is saying that those maps are not okay. Meanwhile, they've got an election in November. That is a really underreported story that is crazy super interesting to see whether voters are actually going to be able to vote, in what districts they're going to vote, and what's going to happen. That'll likely very quickly go to the Florida Supreme Court.
Because ultimately, this goes, if it doesn't work like this, it goes to the judicial branch, and the judges sort it out.
Yeah. Okay, we've got more questions.
One more here.
No. You've had
address
two.
Prop one. Address prop one.
Well, let's get to prop one in a little bit, but I want to make sure everyone gets questions if they've got them, so that we're just not the only ones talking.
Not to hark too much on the primary, but is there any discussion in Lansing or anywhere else about turning Michigan into an open primary like they have in California for the state and local
election? The jungle primary?
Yes.
Yeah. No.
Well, and part of the reason why, and this applies to both parties, people say, do we really want the other party picking our candidates? I mean, some people say we want to do away with primaries as much as possible, with open primaries such as they are now. We want party registration. We want Democrats nominating Democrats. We want Republicans nominating Republicans. Because...
although I'm not going to lie, as political analysts, it's super fun to watch that. You might remember the Republican primary, presidential primary, where Democrats were trying to get each other to vote in the Republican primary for Santorum so that Romney would lose Michigan, thinking that that would be a huge blow. We saw that absolutely happen. Bush v. McCain.
I think Mark Schauer was one of those voters, as a matter of fact.
Historically, we have seen in Democratic primaries George Wallace and then Jesse Jackson win. Why is that?
Right. Because people like to create chaos.
Do we have any chance for a robust renewable energy standard to pass given the abysmal loss of that in the last election?
Yes.
Ooh, I want to give that to Chris Kolb. Chris.
Yeah, it's not going to be easy, but it is doable. What form it takes is really under discussion. Originally, everyone was thinking that 2015, 2016, that session would be the better session because they were going to get rid of some folks in the House who I will say their characters. that even the business community was like, just wait. The problem is that a lot of those people are now going to be in the Senate, and the reasonable Senate's not going to be as reasonable as they're thinking. So there's now a push to see, can we get this done before the end of the year? It's going to be threading a needle, and it's going to be really difficult to do. But there are other ways. We may not have necessarily a mandate. There may be ways of giving the Public Service Commission more power and getting it to go that way. It's going to happen. We're going to move forward. I can't tell you. But you got utilities aren't opposed. The governors they're not necessarily opposed to it. The governors in favor of it.
They just want to make sure they get paid for it.
And they do. They do. Mm-hmm. They make the investment. They get the return, a natural return on investment, and that's how they make their money. The governors, you got all the other groups are. It's factions within the legislature who don't agree with mandates and standards that are a problem. Some people think that we shouldn't be subsidizing certain activities with the energy efficiency. But I will tell you, one of the interesting partners that we have on this is the Christian Coalition. And now Right to Life is coming on board as well. They're telling us, on a lot of issues you may not agree with some of these new legislators coming in. But on this issue, we think there won't be as opposed as you're thinking. And we think we can work with them. And that's really starting to be a game changer. When you get, the Christian Coalition, Right to Life, and other what you consider very, traditional conservative, groups coming on board, I think it's just time before we do move forward.
Really, it's an argument over how you get there. That does the government step in and say, here's what you have to do and here's your percentages versus what's called sort of the all of the above, and how do you get there? And one of the other thing that's driving this is more and more of not just progressives but conservatives are also seeing this as a national security issue. That the less energy that you're getting from overseas, the more conservative the country is getting. The flashpoint is in pipelines and things like that, but there is a consensus that here is better than there.
In Georgia, it was a Tea Party that saved the solar carve-out in their renewable energy legislation because they see it as being able to control their own energy destiny, and so they don't want government doing it. They would like to be able to have their own energy, source right there. It's amazing. I mean, these things are always fun. They're very important, but if you can take a step back, you can build a big enough coalition, you can make stuff happen.
Yeah. Okay, and so we've got about 7 minutes left, so let's try to get in as many questions as we... Yeah, lightning round. Yeah.
I have a question about the Great Lakes State's embrace of Satan in the form of fracking, if you have a comment about that.
Tell me how you really feel.
hey, Paul.
Paul Welday, you want to jump in on that one?
Well, I don't know what to say. I mean, I think fracking is here to stay. And whether you like it or not, you're going to see fracking.
The technology, are public radio. Let's try to keep an eye.
No, the technology has advanced. It is a safe, proven technology, and it works very well. It helps to address the issue that we were just talking about, and you're going to see more and more fracking. That's a prediction. Okay, you can disagree with me, but I'm going to tell you that is working, and in many cases working well. The bigger issue for the Great Lakes states really is, if I might shift the subject, is the Asian carp issue, which continues to be a problem here in the Great Lakes.
Okay. Well, we should have started with fracking. Wow, really involved.
But I'll tell you this, if a Democrat is elected governor, there will still be fracking.
Okay, Chris, I would
kill
love to...
two birds with one stone.
Chris, I would love to hear, as president of the Michigan Environmental Council, where is the MEC on fracking? We heard Debbie Dingell, the most likely, congresswoman of Ann Arbor, saying fracking can be done safely, that there needs to be more regulations, likely to be Ann Arbor's next congresswoman. So let's talk a little bit about where Democrats stand on fracking.
Well, I can't say where Democrats stand. I can tell you where our organization is made up of 75 environmental groups around the state. There are probably three positions on fracking within that coalition. One is on stricter, more regulation of what's going on. The second one would be a moratorium until we can prove that it's safe or can be done safely. The third is to ban it outright. The only thing that can happen right now under this with the current legislature and the current governor will be to make stricter, regulation of the activity. Michigan was lucky in one sense in that we were doing vertical fracking, very shallow drilling down for decades, using very little water in it. We at least had regulations. Lots of states had zero regulations. We also were lucky in that we had regulations that had a longer length of the case. I talked with my hands. We talked about this. Terry Lynn Land and I have one thing in common. We talk with our hands.
Can't do this, guys.
Sorry. Inside joke. You weren't on Mackinac. You don't probably know about it. They have proposed some improvements on the regulations. They don't go far enough. Unless you are able to build a huge war chest and really have probably $30 million dollars or more going to the vote of the people, we're not going to see a ban on fracking to save the
Which, by
Michigan.
The way, we are going to see the petition drive. I don't know whether or not they'll be able they'll have the wherewithal to pull it together. They were not able to the last time.
They're
around.
Saying what they'd like to try to do, though, is in 2016 when, again, as Paul was talking about, when there is a president on the top of the ballot hoping that more Democrats will turn out and would likely be more likely to vote against
fracking. I think marijuana
fracking.
Legalization has got a place in the line ahead of the anti-fracking initiative.
Yeah, or like
but
2012.
It's, but
will
it's
be a
not
lot
one
ballot.
Or the other. These are not mutually exclusive,
right,
and it's we're seeing a lot more politics by ballot drive.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Good evening. Mark Schauer was mentioned a few moments ago, and I think recent polls indicate he's within striking distance of Governor Schneider. How do you explain that?
Well, in my view, what you're seeing is that you've got a governor in particular who's a guy who really puts politics aside. I mean, a lot of us in the Republican Party have said, hey, governor, let's engage. But he's been much more focused on issues and policy. Now, I think that Mark Schauer, again, this is my opinion, has hit his high water mark in regards to this election. I think that Governor Snyder is going to expand his lead now that we're in August, we're after the primary, and you're going to see Governor Snyder win by a healthy margin when all's said and done.
Any politician who says that he's not focused on politics is lying. that's just a reality.
Have you met Rick Snyder?
I have.
Okay.
And you may, pretending to be apolitical can be great politics. Any politician who says he or she is not focused on politics is lying, period.
And let's
However, there is now, so there is a lot of crap polling out there, a lot.
And if anyone's playing a drinking game, I think that's like the ninth time Rick has said crap polling
tonight. It's the second time I've said it.
So
I'm just instituting it now in the last 2 minutes.
And a lot of it is based on pollsters are not doing a very vigorous job of sorting through who is a likely voter. And that's how you sort through how elections are going to be decided, and that is why we have polls on elections.
I'll give you my take on it. I think that you know, rarely has an incumbent governor lost. Rarely. Jim Blanchard's probably the last one. And running for your first re-election, they've all, I think, pretty much won in the modern era. So you got to say that the governor's...
And a second-term governor has not since before George Romney.
Yeah. So you've got to think that's good. Where I think the governor... Okay, number one, I got to preference this. Both Mark Schauer and Rick Snyder are personal friends of mine. It's really difficult when you have two friends running, you know, for governor for the same seat.
Name dropper.
I am a name dropper. hey, I got a bear hug from the governor up on Mackinac. It's kind of cool, you know. But anyways, going back to this, I think where the governor made a huge mistake is he ruined his brand. His brand was to be sort of that non-politician, the tough nerd. All those things. He had a great brand going until Right to Work. And after that, he really started to ruin his brand. And you know, I'm not talking about the politics of it, right or wrong in the policy. His brand started to get diminished. And so he's opened himself up to some attacks. Now, what Mark's got to do is Mark has got not just attack the governor. He's got to put out a vision of what Michigan will look like when after his first 4 years. The governor's got to tell us what he's going to do in the next 4 years and what his vision is, not just more of the same, but when I'm done, this is what Michigan's going to look for. And I would urge all of you to demand of your candidates, they tell you not what the other guy's doing wrong, but what their vision for Michigan is, and vote for the person whose vision matches what your vision for the state is.
That's good advice. Yeah. So, just to follow up on Rick's crap polling, two numbers that you ought to keep in mind. One is the job approval number. Rick Snyder's job approval is somewhere in 58-59%, but his ballot question, when compared to Mark Schauer, is somewhere around 46-47%, depending on what day it is, which is a very interesting thing. We normally don't see that sort of a spread. As a general rule, the ballot number is going to come a lot closer to the job approval number than the other way around. And so I think when this is said and done, well, I think people are still not quite sold on Rick Snyder, the guy. But they like the job he's doing. At the end of the day, I think they're going to pull that lever, and he'll win something like 54-46 when the election's over.
Okay, and we've got one final question. I also want to say Rick and I will stick around for a little bit and answer questions. I can't speak for Chris and for Paul, but maybe they'll do the same. And so, that, you know, if you've got other things you want to keep talking about. But so we'll go out on one final question. Yeah.
Hi. Oh, sorry.
Hi.
Hello.
Sorry about that. I was just wondering if you had any thoughts or any opinion on the upcoming state conventions. Any surprises coming out of the party conventions?
Let's go to Paul on that
first. Yeah, Thursday night, county political conventions. What should we be looking out for?
County political conventions. We're going to be looking to see the split between the so-called establishment delegates, the Tea Party influence. The real race at the Republican convention is Lieutenant Governor Brian Kelly is being challenged by a Tea Party activist by the name of Wes Nakagiri. The conventional wisdom is that the Lieutenant Governor should win going away. But it could make for interesting politics because you never know what's going to happen on a convention floor.
Rick and I like to say the GOP conventions are like the wild, wild west, and we've seen that happen in the past couple of years.
You know, they picked the wrong lieutenant governor candidate. You can see what could happen in Virginia when they had the real crazy, you know, running as lieutenant governor. They pick them differently there. But they would be...
You all understand that we choose our lieutenant governor candidate at party conventions, not on the ballot or primaries.
I think the Republicans would be really stupid if they don't reaffirm that Brian Kelly is their lieutenant governor candidate going forward. And they would really give Mark Schauer an opening if they kick him off the ballot for Tea Party, you know, activist.
Yeah.
It would be really
I agree on that.
Difficult for the governor. And if the governor gets reelected and he's got this guy that he doesn't even agree with, you know, and who's is the 20th vote in a tie in the Senate.
Yeah.
I mean, it could be really difficult. Yeah. You know, I'm not going to say that what I hope they do. I really think that for politics to work in the state, we need good people running. We need a solid team on both sides. So regardless of who wins, the state's in good hands. I would be very afraid if Brian Kelly is not the lieutenant governor for Rick Snyder. And I think that, you know, I know him. He is a name dropping again. But two,
he gave Chris a job. No one here cares.
But, you know, he
that's
is
more
a
time
solid,
than I said crap polling.
Solid conservative. And if the Republican Party doesn't realize that, they're in big trouble. And I can tell you, I've had the same conversation with the head of the Michigan Chamber of Commerce, with lots of other people in Lansing. And there is a fight going on for, you know, the real, you know, life of the GOP. And
two things.
I'm hoping that, you know, the people will choose, come to their senses, and pick the right candidate. They're doing a great job. Both sides are doing a great job trying to get their votes. The county conventions are interesting because I think Oakland-Macomb may prove to be which side gets enough delegates out of those two county conventions may determine the whole thing.
Yeah. Two things. Oh. There was a wave of write-in of candidates and winners for precinct delegate races on primary night. Those are wild cards, too. If Wes Nakagiri posed a real threat to Brian Kelly on the at the convention, his name would not be entered into nomination.
Okay. On that note, we're going to wrap up because we took a few more minutes, but we started a little late. So thank you, everyone, so much for coming out tonight, for battling the rain. And I also want to
thank... And you won!
I want to thank Chris Cole, Paul Welday for coming out. And like I said, we'll be happy to answer questions if you've got them. Please feel free to come on up. And again, thanks so much for coming on such a rainy night, although now it seems to clear it up. So enjoy the rest of your evening.